Prelude, Detective Comics number 267, cover dated February 1959. A convertible carload of gangsters pulled up to an armored truck and used a device resembling a tuba to suck the money right out. The guards tried to draw their firearms, but were frozen in place by a second fantastic weapon. When the news reached the police station, Captain Harding bellowed,
"Bah! Super magnets! Paralyzing rays! This I've got to see for myself! Come along, Detective Jones!"
With a swarm of other police cars, Harding and Jones encircled ex-convict Bugsy Roach and his boys. Guns drawn, Harding and his troops approached, demanding,
"Don't be a fool, Bugsy! We've got you surrounded! You can't get away!"
Super weapons from a space capsule found in an empty lot said different, much to Jones's chagrin.
"Great stars. Those are Martian weapons. They must have fallen out of a spaceship and somehow floated to Earth."
In this case, Bugsy sped away thanks to a super heat wave rifle that melted bullets in midair. Jones slipped off to assume his superpowered Martian form when Captain Harding happened by.
"Jones, you're changing into an invisible outer space being. Why, you must be a Martian!"
Wincing, Jones thought,
My secret is out.
Imagine his relief when Harding assumed,
"Wait, what am I saying? It must be Bugsy's outer space weapons that changed you somehow. Jones, wherever you are, tell me, what will you do now that you've been changed in such a terrible manner?"
Still invisible, Jones played along.
"My only hope is to get hold of those weapons, Captain."
Super Eyes followed the getaway car's tracks to a cabin off a dirt road. Bugsy's men were almost immediately alerted to his presence.
"Great falling stars. A Martian radar scope which can even detect invisible objects approaching."
Bugsy figured, invisible or no, just point a ray gun where the radar scope said the intruder stood.
I may be the most powerful being on Earth, but I'm helpless against ray guns from my own planet. I must reach those weapons first. Great rings of Saturn. I accidentally knocked over an oil lamp and started a fire."
Great googly moogly. You'd expect a hemophiliac to be ever vigilant against sharp edges, but this big doofus can't manage to avoid a lit oil lamp? Warning signs. Light. Heat. Kerosene vapor. Odor. Often presence in shacks near a cabin.
Ugh.
If you've ever seen a Warner Brothers cartoon, you know what else is always in that rustic shack out back. A barrel of gunpowder. The Martian Manhunter noted this and rolled it where the fire was most intense. That would be a boom with three O's.
Boom!
It worked. The blast couldn't damage my Martian body, but it hurled me out of here in a hurry.
I suppose invulnerability didn't leave the body with the super strength lost to the blaze in the shack? In this story, at least? The Super Lawman laid out the explosively disarmed gang invisibly, and John Jones hauled them to jail. Captain Harding mentioned,
"I'm certainly glad you found the weapon to turn you back to normal before the whole lot was destroyed in the fire, Jones."
John thought to himself,
"Yes, my secret weapon is my own Martian powers, which I will use only to uphold the law."
The Menace of the Martian Weapons was written by Jack Miller and drawn by Joe Serta.
A podcast for John Jones, the manhunter from Mars, his world, and the vile menagerie of villains he must confront.
When the secret origin of the JLA was told in the February 1962 cover dated Justice League of America number 9, it was stated that the team was celebrating their third anniversary in that very issue. For the more literal-minded, that meant the team formed at a point in 1959, more than half a year before Hal Jordan's debut as Green Lantern in the September-October issue of Showcase number 22. Writer Steve Englehart took this seeming gaffe and turned it into the basis of an extra-length and guest-star-packed issue of Justice League in 1977, built on the conceit that a prototype version of the group had a solitary adventure at exactly the three-year mark, intersecting with National Periodical Publications' February 1959 cover-dated titles. Comic historians used to make a big deal about a set of DC superheroes who managed to be continuously published from World War II through the fallow post-war period into the Silver Age revival of the genre. Only Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman maintained their own solo series during this period. Robin, of course, appeared in the Batman titles and in World's Finest alongside Superman and Batman, but his solo strip had ended when Star Spangled Comics was canceled with the July 1952 cover dated issue number 130. In 1959, Green Arrow and Speedy were appearing as backups in World's Finest Comics and Adventure Comics. Aquaman was also in Adventure Comics, battling a man-made imitator in February's issue number 257. Wonder Woman was on issue 104, in which she battled the Duke of Deception. From there, Englehart looked to newer superhero-related series to draw in his protagonists. Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane number 7, was out in February, while Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen number 34, was out the previous month. The Challengers of the Unknown had debuted exactly 2 years earlier in Showcase number 6, and were on the 6th issue of their eponymous title by this point. The Flash had only just graduated to his own solo title this month, resuming the numbering of the Golden Age Flash series with issue 105. Congo Bill had stayed active since 1940. He even had his own movie serial. At this point, he was active in Action Comics, specifically that month's issue number 249. Just an issue prior, Bill had gained the ability to trade his consciousness with that of the powerful Golden Kong Gorilla. The Adventures of Rex the Wonder Dog number 43 was still on the stands, but sadly the backup feature Detective Chimp wasn't represented here. Adam Strange had debuted in Showcase number 17 just a couple of months prior. Unfortunately for me, Englehart had missed another sci-fi hero I like more, Captain Comet, who had been revived in 1976's Secret Society of Supervillains No. 2 after his previous strip had ended with October 1954's Strange Adventures No. 49. Tapping out on characters originally published by National, Englehart had to reach backwards and outwards to take fuller advantage of his novel premise. The Blackhawks were published by the competing Quality Comics until the December 1956 cover dated number 104. Then they were released to National Periodical Publications, who resumed the series with the next issue. DC eventually bought the Blackhawks outright and continued their title for another 12 years, mostly drawn by Dick Dillon until he took over the JLA from Mike Sekowski. The issue contemporaneous to our story's setting was number 133, which introduced Zinda the Lady Blackhawk, but she didn't make it into the retcon. Robot Man had not been seen since Detective Comics number 202, cover dated December 1953, drawn by future Manhunter from Mars artist Joe Serta in the very same title and slot. Vigilante had last appeared in the November 1954 cover dated Action Comics number 198, and is an oddly controversial inclusion, since most of Greg Sanders' adventures were assumed to have taken place on Earth 2. This is one of only a handful of appearances of the so-called Earth 1 Greg Sanders, even though there being two different versions of the same guy was merely a contrivance for anal retentive continuity nerds rendered moot by Crisis on Infinite Earths anyway. Plastic Man made it all the way to November 1956's issue number 64 before Quality Comics closed down its operations. Unfortunately, National declined to continue his series when they picked up the rights to that company's catalog. The Pliable Paladin could have been one of the greats, riding the second wave of popularity superheroes were only beginning to enjoy, but instead he was mothballed and replaced by the inferior Elongated Man, though not until 1960. It's too bad Englehart didn't take advantage of any other Quality acquisitions, though they were typically more steeped in World War II and associated with other Earths in the DC multiverse. Speaking of which, it might have been fun to have Plaz joined by fellow non-DC heavy hitter Captain Marvel, but all the Fawcett characters were on Earth-S and still only licensed to DC in 1977. I could talk about how that didn't stop the Big Red Cheese from visiting Vigilante, Plastic Man, and Robot Man on Earth 2 in Roy Thomas's 1980s All-Star Squadron, but I already have a headache and that would just make it worse. Englehart cheated a bit with Rip Hunter, who wasn't published until the May-June cover-dated Showcase No. 20. Ironically, John Jones's supposed longtime nemesis Commander Blanks and the White Martians who play the villains in the story didn't exist before 1969, despite being retconned into participating in an epilogue to the 1959 Manhunter from Mars strip we covered at the top of the show. It's funny to me that Englehart's story exists to create retroactive continuity that corrects an error made in a 1961 retcon to provide the JLA with an origin story in which he heavily employs a 1969 retcon used to explain why John Jones remained on Earth to serve the JLA instead of returning to Mars with their help in 1959. And in spite of all that effort, nobody ever figured out why Captain Harding didn't recognize the Martian Manhunter as the same alien Detective John Jones was supposedly turned into by the Martian weapons from earlier the same year. Regardless, Englehart has to be congratulated on the extraordinary effort of undertaking a project like this when there were no comic book stores or internet databases to consult. Never mind that Dick Dillon had to turn out the lengthy Justice League of America number 144 with its dozens of characters as though it were any other issue. The production of this story is as heroic as its subjects. And now, July 1977's The Origin of the Justice League, minus one.
Dedicated to truth, justice and peace for all mankind. The world's greatest super friends.
Green Arrow, having spent some time reading through old League journals on their satellite, allowed his detective mind to activate his knee-jerk reactionism. It seemed that the date the League was said to have formed was 7 months prior to Hal Jordan's having become Green Lantern, much less his starting to work with other heroes. Ollie felt he'd been lied to, and let Hal have it, but the also-present Superman stepped in.
Okay, Arrow, you've caught us red-handed, and I, for one, am just as glad the secret's out.
Superman led the pair to a viewing room on the League satellite, where Ollie watched a video pre-recorded by John Jones before he left the team.
As you listen, please understand why we had to hide the truth. It wasn't you we feared. It was the times.
Jones related the story of his arrival on Earth in 1955, with much of the dialogue and layouts taken directly from Detective Comics number 225, his first appearance.
Soon, I found employment as a police detective, but even sooner, I learned how correct I had been to hide my true identity.
Vice President Nixon was pushing bomb shelters. The Red Scare was in full effect. Campaigns against juvenile delinquency focused on scapegoats like comic books. People had begun seeing, and fearing, UFOs.
Everywhere I went, I heard words of fear and bravado, as if this country I had appeared in were under attack, and yet no attack ever came. I saw only prosperity and paranoia. It was quite curious. Naturally, therefore, I used what knowledge I possessed to attempt repairs on the robot brain. Dr. Odell had been a genius, however, and my efforts wrought no effect for several years. But on the night of February 11th, 1959,
a news report announced Superman's defeat of Lex Luthor, as related in Action Comics number 249.
Yes, and I saved Middletown from the Martian weapons that somehow fell to Earth and nearly died in the process. But no one knows it, because of my vow to hide from the humans. I've accomplished much good here, but all of it invisibly. I'm not a slave to my ego, but I have a normal Martian pride. Perhaps, with my record, it is time to announce myself.
Just then, Jones's archenemy Commander Blanks appeared with a squad of pale Martians in Jones's home.
You should not be surprised, Jones. Did you not find our trial offerings, the Martian weapons?
Blanks had been responsible for Jones being sent into exile on his native Mars before Dr. Odell's robot brain dragged him to Earth. As a result of Jones's work on the device, its probe ray had begun appearing near his place of exile and had been detected by Blanks. The Commander sent the capsule of weapons as a trial teleportation before he and his men allowed themselves to pay Jones a visit.
I cursed my blunder, but held the Commander's eyes. He had wanted to kill me in our previous encounter. Only my popularity with my people saved me, and my people were far away now.
Jones backed away from the pales toward his lab.
You are a cool one, Jones. I'll sleep better when you're gone.
Jones reached for a sink with valves marked as air, water, and fire, and set off a blaze.
The flames weakened me, though not quite so much in my Earth form, and I was prepared for them. Blanks and his men will be helpless while I escape.
Jones waited a half hour for the pales to exit his lab as he had, but none came. Jones cut the main gas supply to find the robot brain melted to slag and his fellow Martians presumably having returned home before it was rendered useless.
After this reminder of what I left behind, my homesickness is completely cured. It is just as well.
The next morning, an unusually svelte Captain Harding announced pale-skinned aliens were running riot on the south side of town. They had just teleported to safety elsewhere in Middletown.
Blanks and his men will stop at nothing. They proved that on Mars. They want me to come to them, and I must oblige.
Jones reverted to his Martian form and turned invisible, but one of Blanks' men detected his heartbeat. Jones began throwing fists, while Blanks threw a pistol.
You've had your way with the backwards humans, Jean, but you're as vulnerable as any Martian to this microwave pistol.
The beam pained Jones, but he retained his strength and beat the stuffing out of Blanks. Just then a voice demanded Jones should freeze in place.
Standing amidst the rubble was a human in scarlet and gold. I had seen some newspaper photos from Central City, but I knew little about the Flash. My initial reaction was instinctive.
Jones turned invisible, but Flash moved across the room with speed enough to cover every square inch until he reached the Martian's jaw. It was a trick he'd learned in Flash number 106 a week prior, when faced with the Mirror Master. Set on his butt, Jones tried a different approach.
Yes, here I am, friend, and I am a friend. It is the pale-skinned Martians who have done the damage here. I sought to stop them, but if you fight for justice, I am on your side.
A woman's scream pierced the air from an overlooking apartment window. As tenants were horrified to spy these invading aliens, one went so far as to take aim with a rifle, which Flash raced up the side of the building to slap from his hand. As John Jones vanished after the fleeing pale Martians, Flash chastised,
"You fool! You frightened him, and now he's gone, along with the ones he said were his enemies. With their powers, how can I track them? Why didn't you let him finish what he was saying?"
The crowd just dismissed all Martians as alien invaders, and even started to question whether the Flash was one too.
"I had to get away from them. Those people were scared, in an ugly mood, and since I'll never reveal my true identity as a police scientist, they might well have turned on me."
John Jones and the disguised pale Martians separately observed Flash spend hours tracking aliens he could not perceive in his midst, as an hysterical crowd began to form around Middletown City Hall. Captain Harding tried to quiet their fears and accusations, but having failed, turned to the Flash. Barry Allen likened the mess to Orson Welles' famous broadcast of War of the Worlds, then invoked the unimpeachable name of Superman to mollify the crowd. Shimmy didn't actually know the Man of Steel. Barry Allen, the Flash, raced from a crowd frightened by Martians in Middletown in search for help.
"I've never met Superman, or any other superheroes around America. My assumption of superpowers has been strictly a local thing. I hope he doesn't give me the brush off. I know how those big stars can be."
To gain attention, the Flash climbed a spiral on top of the Metro building and waited for someone to come calling. That turned out to be Superman, Batman, and Robin, to whom he explained the situation.
"Of course we'll lend a hand, Flash,"
said Superman.
"We'll help too, right, Batman? Oh boy, Martians!"
"Calm down, youngster. We'll come, Flash. But if this is a full-scale invasion, the three of us may not be able to give you enough help. Maybe we should alert some of our friends. Aquaman, Green Arrow."
Flash passed, wanted to keep a lid on the situation, but a tipster overheard and made a call to television station WGBS. Back in Middletown, John Jones spotted a group of men crippled by the sight of a welder's blowtorch.
"These are Martians, who haven't learned to take on Earthman's attributes, together with their outward forms."
Two pales bolted to stir a crowd, while the third surprised Jones by assuming his face. This was likely Blanks, who explained to the real Jean his trap. Only Jones would have noticed the weakened Martians, and he would have to flee if he didn't want the town to spot two Detective Joneses.
If Detective Jones were revealed as a Martian, Martian. All of Middletown would turn on me.
The false Jones shot John in the back, then observed him revert to Martian form. The pales turned invisible, and the remaining Detective Jones took the green Martian into his custody. Flash and the world's finest trio were greeted in Middletown by Captain Carding, who was praying they had a clue where his ace detective and the captured Martian had gotten to. Also, Roy Raymond, TV detective, had followed up on that lead concerning Martians in Middletown. Harding admonished, "Now see you here, Raymond. We don't want publicity." Karen, Raymond's assistant, on Impossible But True, defended the rights of the press. Raymond, star of another former Detective Comics backup strip, broadcast a report that drew a small army of exceptional persons to Middletown. It seemed like the only DC all-stars not to show up were Green Arrow and Speedy, who were on vacation to Starfish Island in Detective Comics number 256 at the time. Batman had this most super of groups divide into teams and spread out to monitor the globe. Jimmy Olsen, Plastic Man, and the Blackhawks chased a red herring that led them to nearly discover Rip Hunter, Time Master, and his partner Jeff's secret operation. Lois Lane, Robot Man, Congo Bill, Vigilante, and the Challengers of the Unknown nearly foiled Adam Strange's chance to catch a Zeta Beam back to Ran and his lady love Alana. Only the world's finest trio, Wonder Woman, Flash, Aquaman, Roy Raymond, and Rex the Wonder Dog, headed in the right direction. It seemed Ferris Aircraft was involved with a satellite launch at Cape Canaveral, and a test pilot on the site, Hal Jordan, had been shot from ambush by a ray gun. Everyone was impressed that he was still on his feet and able to show the lot where the dirty business had gone down. At the launch pad, Rex scented trouble. Superman used heat vision to flush out the invisible pails.
Hera, help us. It's raining Martians.
Blanks thought to himself,
by Jupiter's fire.
He then attacked the Man of Steel without mercy.
Great Scott, his power rivals mine.
Commander Blanks taunted,
you seem strong, Blue One, but I come from another planet, and on Earth I am invincible.
Not so, as the Kryptonian decked him.
That's what they all say, but I'm out of this world too.
Wonder Woman enjoyed pitting her Amazon strength against aliens, while the Flash helped Aquaman with a hydration issue, giving the Sea King power enough to flatten a Martian. Robin noticed water droplets on the rocket took the form of a once invisible man, so the caped Crusaders climbed up to gently release him.
Thank you, my friends. Had you not intervened, I would have been shot into space with the satellite tomorrow, to my death.
Robin asked, gosh, but aren't you a Martian too? John Jones confirmed.
I am, lad, but not a Martian such as they. And to prove it, I'll tell you the most closely guarded secret of any Martian, our one fatal weakness.
With that reveal, Superman's revisiting heat vision did the rest. Roy Raymond confirmed of John.
And you say you're a good Martian, living right here among us.
Superman interjected.
But not for much longer. I admit you helped us, but I'm flying all of you back to Mars.
John argued.
Oh no, Superman. Take them if you will, but I wish to remain. Once I would have sold my soul to return home. Now I see the truth I should have seen years ago. The Mars I loved is gone. It is a world of lost causes and dead dreams. Evil triumphed over good there, but here, on Earth, the eternal struggle continues. Here, one such as I, and one such as yourselves, can still tip the balance the right way. I love my adopted world. It needs a manhunter from Mars.
Superman acknowledged.
I can understand that.
Flash explained.
But the world won't, John. The news stories and hysteria generated in finding you have made it impossible for any Martian, good or evil, to appear now.
Aquaman, Wonder Woman, and Superman all agreed that given 6 months for things to calm down, and with their full support as a club, the Martian Manhunter could be accepted by the public. Batman wished to remain a loner, but that didn't work for the Flash.
But Batman, a league against evil. Our purpose would be to uphold justice against whatever dangers threatens it.
Superman asked that he take his time to think it over, while Raymond did his part by vowing to a press blackout on the affair.
And so it was decided. All of us swore silence.
The world chalked the Martian invasion up to mass hysteria.
It was several months after, when I lost my ability to use my powers while invisible, that we had our first official case. The case we maintained first brought us together. Of course, Robin, Roy, and Hal weren't members, but a new hero, Green Lantern, was. Still, we've always celebrated the original day. I hope now you understand, because it opened this world for me.
Green Lantern leaned into Oliver Queen.
Naturally, John didn't know I was Hal Jordan. He left Earth before we revealed our true identities to each other. John only told us his John Jones identity after he abandoned it in 1964.
Green Arrow felt he should be teed off, but knew,
here's a nice thing you did for old John. I'm kind of sorry I missed him when he was on Earth recently. Now let me out of here. I got something in my eye.
Ollie may have shed a tear for John, but he knew not of what he spoke. That recent visit he mentioned was when the Manhunter was running loose like a mad Martian, accusing every hero he saw of murdering Ray Zeta. John has always been loving toward Aquaman and gotten nothing but grief in return. Meanwhile, Green Arrow has treated Martian Manhunter like a saint since their first team-up, and he'd have doubtless been battered by the Jay Jackass of the 70s regardless. Steve Englehart, Dick Dillon, and Frank McLaughlin created one of the most influential DC Comics ever with this tale. While retroactive continuity was nothing new even then, writing such a massive crossover of isolated features
features into a pre-origin tale filled with cross-referenced minutiae, first meetings, and other rampant revisionism, this was truly the Marvel Age of DC Comics. Speaking of isolation, the lonely, needy orientation of John Jones that led to his post-crisis role as widowed last living Martian likely started here. So too is defining ties to McCarthyism, and really treating him as a period character in general, a wellspring for quality Martian Manhunter stories from the late 80s on. American Secrets, New Frontier, they all seem to come from here. Heck, the story even preceded Paul Levitz's using the House Un-American Activities Commission as an excuse for DC's heroes vanishing in the 50s by a couple of years, with his more famous The Defeat of the Justice Society story from Adventure Comics number 466, covered in November-December 1979. This was a truly great work, and as such, endlessly copied, but never duplicated. Since this story, John Jones has been defined more as a member of the Justice League of America than as a solo hero. It's probable that being a founding member of the team was the salvation of the character from the obscurity that befell most of the guest stars appearing in this issue. The tale introduced the notion of the Manhunter having such strong emotional ties to the team as to see it as his surrogate family. Too often, the sleuth from outer space's very identity has been subsumed by his membership, and in my experience, I've noted that the most dismissive critics of the character usually only know him through his role in the JLA. Despite this ongoing issue, I hold this specific story blameless, since it is saturated with Martian Manhunter history. Besides directly referencing the stories of his origin, Brett, and the cachet of Martian weapons, it remains the second and final appearance of Commander Blanks. I feel Blanks is the most important villain in the Alien Atlas's rogues gallery, certainly in part due to this story claiming the White Martians as the primary motivation for the very formation of the JLA. It's likely the strong connection of Martians to the JLA also prompted Grant Morrison to use them in his first arc of the hugely successful 1997 revival series, and which remains one of the team's best stories with some of its most oft-referenced highlight moments. As important as the JLA is to John Jones, the occasional tale like this one reminds folks how important he has been to the JLA, down to its core.
And when the evening comes, we smile.
In 1994, Mark Waid, Brian Augustine, and Barry Kitson began exploring the beginnings of the world's greatest superhero team over an epic 12-issue comic maxi series.
Dude, I think Mark Waid was still doing Justice League Task Force in 1994. I think you're thinking of 1998.
That team was the Justice League of America, and that comic was JLA Year One. In 2016, 8 podcasts will come together to cover this series in a single month. That month is JL May.
Well, if you look at Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, I think they say the first issue of JLA Year One came out in 1997, but I think most people would probably say it was 1998, right? Together. Sorry, I don't mean to step on your ad. You go ahead.
Featuring the Fire and Water Podcast, The Power of Fishnets, Waiting for Doom, The Lantern Cast, Supermates Podcast, The Idlehead of Diabolu, Comic Reflections, and Views from the Long Box. Each podcast will cover one or two issues of JLA Year One, and then coverage will move from show to show. It all starts in the Fire and Water Podcast with issues 1 and 2.
Oh, and on the Idlehead, I'm also doing a supplemental thing called JLA Day One, where I look at
JL May, an epic month for an epic series. Available where you find all good podcasts.
They'll figure it out. It'll be a link or something. It's fine. I really prefer Superstar.
Doom Patrol.
1963.
Doom Patrol debut.
My Greatest Adventure, issue 80. 1964.
My Greatest Adventure renamed Doom Patrol.
Issue 85. 1968.
Doom Patrol destroyed.
Issue 121. 1976.
The new Doom Patrol.
Showcase 94. 1987.
Doom Patrol Volume 2.
Kupperberg Lytle. 1989.
Morrison and Case.
Issue 19. 1993.
Pollack.
Issue 64. 2001.
Doom Patrol Volume 3.
Arcudi Hewitt. 2004.
Doom Patrol Volume 4.
Burn.
Shush.
2009.
Doom Patrol Volume 5.
Giffen Clark. 2012 2013 2014 2015 2016.
Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, because we're waiting.
available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com. Right, I guess that's it for us with these issues. But if you want to continue on with the love fest for JLA U1, from here you need to listen to the next episode of the Lantern Cast, which should be out a day or two after our episode. And after the Lantern Cast, so they do issues 7 and 8 after Lantern Cast, you can listen to Cindy and Chris, who do Supermates, the Supermates podcast. They're doing issue 9. And then you can listen to the Idle Head of Diablo, which is Frank. Frank is amazing. He can do like a 2-hour podcast in an hour, just because of the way he speaks, and it's packed full of information. So Frank, and he does sound effects and voices, so Frank will take you through issue 10, and then Nicholas and maybe Jeff and maybe Spencer will help with Comic Reflections. They're doing JLA Year 1 number 11, so that's Comic Reflections for that one, which is getting towards later in the month. And then the final episode will be Views from the Long Box, doing issue 12. So that's Michael Bailey's podcast. He's a bit of he's a newcomer to podcasts, but, you know, we'll put up with him. Anyway, so that's where we go from here. So we'll have a promo now, and then we'll come back with the Mailbag of Doom.
To tell you the story of Green Lantern is to tell you the story of the birth of a universe, the origins of DC as a whole.
It's a magic emerald meteor from space in the 1940s.
It's the establishment of the JSA.
It's the birth of the Silver Age.
It's the introduction of a universal police force.
It's the formation of the JLA.
It's the emergence of the multiverse.
It's a crisis in both space and time.
It's an emerald dawn.
And it's an emerald twilight.
It's the brightest day.
And the blackest night.
And the Lantern Cast covers all of this and everything in between. We're Green Lantern's greatest advocates and fiercest critics. We've been fans for years, and it's the reason we're self-proclaimed Lanternologists.
So find us on iTunes and Stitcher and give us a listen, because the history of Green Lantern really is the history of the DC Universe, and we've got the interviews, commentaries, reviews, and more to back it up.
Your ego betrays you. Will you not listen to reason? This won't end well for you.
We received retweets from Alan Middleton, the Anti-Fascist, Hicks, Mark Sweeney, and Siskoid, as well as favorites from Illegal Machine, Illit Records, Longbox Graveyard, Marty Light, Michael Bailey Podcasts, the Odyssey Unleashed Podcast, and the Power of Fishnets Podcast. The maniacs from Mars on social media include the 108th Sage, Ange, Between the Pages, Cash Flag, Charlton Hero, Chris Sheehan, Coffee and Comics Blog, Comic Reflections Podcast, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore, and Ed Moore Jr., at Teal Productions, and at Miskatonic, Inigo Montoya, the Film and Water Podcast, Glenn Walker, It's Plastic Man, Jacob Edwards, Joseph Crawford, Carl Disley, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Cord Industries, Luke Dobwalker, Michael Wagner, Mr. Morbid, Not Guano Man, Oscar Blue Devil, Randy Caldwell, Richard Field, Ryan C. at Trash Film Guru, Ryan Daly, Scott Bachman, The Silver and Gold Podcast, Son of Cthulhu, Synod Alias Scarecrow, Trekker Talk, World Worlds Podcast, and the Xenozoic Xenophiles Podcast. Scott Bachman listed us as a Follow Friday tweet hero. Darren and Ruth Sutherland commented on the 1957 episode of the show. Comic review podcast or one-man comedy show or both. Have fun listening to the latest episode. Joseph Crawford said, it's a great show. And Darren and Ruth replied, agree, Joe, consistently fun. Respect for the character and get so much information, yet laugh out loud so often. Not Guano Man commented on my guest appearance on the Secret Origins podcast. A masterful overview analysis of why John Jones is so damn charming by Diablo Frank and Ryan Daly. Firestorm fan wrote, the Idlehead rolls out a hashtag JLMay bonus episode. Great coverage of original JLA origin. Frank, wonderful coverage as always. Very clever idea to do day one episodes on previous JLA origin stories. Hearing your take on history or potentially alternate history always makes for fascinating listening. There should be a new term in the lexicon combining retcon with Frank. Maybe revisionist Frankism. A Frankon? Another possibility to replace Wonder Woman in the post-crisis JLA origin could have been Zatanna. She's a real powerhouse, as Wonder Woman is, and she's only barely derivative of a male character. After all, in 1988, who really remembered Zatara besides Alan Moore and Mark Waid? Shocked me to hear my own voice on the episode, and then realize you were taking a dig at Aqualad for his dig at you. Well played. Notice I leapt to your defense. Keep up the great work. Here's another 60 years of the emerald-hued Man of Tomorrow. Keith G. Baker tweeted, great show. I'm guessing Brett never misses a bike week in Myrtle Beach. He continued in the comments, great show as always, Frank. I never knew Brett was from Eastern North Carolina. Sure sounds like he's from somewhere down east near the South Carolina border. Maybe Columbus County? Loved how you made Hatera sound like somewhere Travis Morgan would find a half-baked sorceress. If you ever decide to make it over to the beautiful Outer Banks, here's a helpful guide on pronunciation.
Hatteras, North Carolina.
Keep up the good work. Can't wait for the next episode about the real first meeting of the JLA. The truth is, I did a fan movie casting for Brett a few years ago, where I went with John Bernthal because I thought he looked the part and he was young enough to play the role in live action. But my first choice was actually another Walking Dead alum, Michael Rooker, who I first saw back in the 80s in Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. So my understanding is he's from Alabama. I just did my best. I'm glad I landed somewhere remotely resembling human speech, despite the fact that I was supposed to be doing a Martian. Finally, Andrew wrote, standard Frank knowledge bomb this episode. I liked the Brett story review most of all, as I didn't know anything about it. Great to finally learn when John revealed himself. I think I was so floored by Justice League of America number 200 as a kid that the Appalachian aliens will always be looked upon fondly. I think the tinkering with JLA history became necessary with the crisis, so I didn't mind the Canary inclusion in the new DCU. But I agree, having every single superpowered being defeated by the tree guy does stretch credibility. Anyway, thanks as usual for all the info. Podcast listeners should feel free to leave a comment on one of our blogs, either the Umbrella Rolled Spine Podcasts or the specific Idle Head of Diablo blog. Both are available quite easily through Google searches. You can also shoot me a tweet at Commander Blanks. That's B-L-A-N-X. Thank you for listening.